I first want to draw your attention to actually another meeting on supernova remnants. This one in July in Beijing. It's part of the COSPAR assembly. I and some other people here in the room are organizers. It's a big assembly, so there are many meetings, and some of the meetings will be about cosmic rays and neutron stars, and we will have some joint meetings together with the supernova remnant meeting. Okay, the talk. Extrasynchrotron emission and magnetic fields in supernova remnants. Of course, I will mostly cover the X-ray emission, but let me start with the cosmic ray spectrum itself. This is cosmic ray spectrum. It consists mostly of ions, so only about 1% or so is electrons. And there is this characteristic shape. It's a power law, and then there's a slight bend, which is called the knee, around 3 times 10 to the 15 EV. Actually, if you blow it up by multiplying it by e to the third, you see very clearly that something is going on here. And then there's something around 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19, which is called the ankle. And it's actually believed that everything up to the knee, and probably even beyond the knee, is of galactic origin. So there must be galactic sources producing them. And then if you go above the ankle, it's probably extragalactic, because the magnetic field of the galaxy is not high enough to contain particles with those energies. So the galaxy is transparent to those particles. So supernova remnants have always been connected with cosmic rays, because supernovae and supernova remnants are the most energetic sources in our galaxy. So if there's any sources that could actually accelerate cosmic rays, that must be supernova remnants. But there is one problem. So energetically it works out okay. But can they actually accelerate up to or beyond the knee? So up to 10 to the 15 EV or even more? And according to standard shock acceleration theory, the answer is actually no. And there's a classic paper by Lagasse and Cesarski. And what they assumed is a galactic B field, nothing to enhance it. And they say, well, you need some realistic parameters. You need a diffusion coefficient. And only in the very optimistic scenario, you can get to the knee. So for Fermi accelerations, what happens? Particles bounce back and forth between the shocked and the unshocked medium. Every time they cross the shock front, they gain some energy. And if you have a very high magnetic field, you need a high magnetic field, because the gyro radius of the particle has to be, of course, very much smaller than the supernova remnant size. Otherwise, you can't bounce back and forth. And you need fast acceleration in order to get there, because if you accelerate and it takes 100,000 years to get there, the supernova remnant will be gone. The particles themselves, they have a sort of random walk in the front of the shock front or at the back of the shock front, and they scatter on magnetic field waves. So not atomic collisions, they are scatterings on plasma waves. And the more scattering, the higher the diffusion, the earlier they recross the shock, so you have a faster diffusion. So it's not only that you need a high magnetic field, you need a very turbulent magnetic field. And the maximum diffusion... I'm sorry. They need a very small mean free path.
Right.
Spatial diffusion. Okay. Well, whatever. The thing is that you need a very small mean free path. And the smallest mean free path that you can get is actually the gyro radius. This is called the Bohm diffusion. So it's either a gyro radius, a mean free path, or it's larger. So here is a sort of cartoon picture. Here's a shock front. You have a jump in density. The standard one is about 4, but actually if you have nonlinear effects, you can get much higher compression ratios. The particles scatter back and forth, and each time they cross, they get energy. And according to the standard Fermi acceleration picture, you get a power law slope that depends on the compression ratio, and it's about e to the minus 2. The earliest evidence, actually, that supernova remnants may indeed accelerate particles is just from radio emission. Cas A, for instance, is a very bright radio source. Here you see a VLA picture. And what you learn from this is that there are relativistic electrons. So they are electrons. And in effect, of course, for the cosmic rays particles we observe on Earth, they are ions. So there is still some mismatch. And also the energies that you see in the radio are rather low, so something like GeV energies. So a big step forward was actually when ASCA discovered that 1006, apart from thermal emission, had also non-thermal emission. Actually, the non-thermal emission was there first, but because they now could spatially resolve that some part has thermal emission and some part has non-thermal emission, they finally said, okay, there must be non-thermal emission X-ray synchrotron emission. So here you see the ASCA spectrum. You see, if you look at the inside, you see all the lines from highly ionized atoms. And if you look here, you see a power law spectrum. And what you can deduce from that, assuming some magnetic field, is that you accelerate up to, say, 5 TeV. With Chandra, actually, we found now out that almost all, or actually all young supernova remnants have non-thermal emission, X-ray synchrotron emission. And most of them actually very near the shock front. So in all those pictures, it's more or less blue. So here you see those nice filaments that are non-thermal. This is Kepler. Kepler is not that bright, but you still see that there is a lot of non-thermal at the outside. Tycho, exactly the same. You see the fluffy thing is actually thermal emission, but the very sharp features here, it's all non-thermal emission, X-ray synchrotron emission. And 1006 also, actually, 1006 is much larger, so the filaments are much broader. I would like to point out, of course, also to Felix's talks, which was about the high-energy TeV emission. And there may be some match between them because... Oops, I'm going too fast. If you have inverse Compton emission, the inverse Compton emission in the TeV is coming from the same particles as the X-ray synchrotron emission. I will talk a little bit about Cas-A because I've done work on that. So here you see the continuum emission. You see some very nice filaments. These here are the sharpest filaments. Here are also some filaments, but it's a little bit more off-axis, so they are not so sharp. And it's there may be also some other reasons why it's not that sharp there. So if you measure here the width, you see it's very narrow, something like 1 to 4 arc seconds. And if you take a spectrum of this region here, you see it's almost non-thermal. There's some thermal emission. If you just go a little bit inside the shock, you see much more thermal emission. So how come that those filaments in say, Cas-A and Tycho and Kepler are so narrow? So Martin Laming and I came up with the following picture. So assume that at the shock front, you accelerate electrons, and you accelerate them to very high energy, more than TeV. The electrons are carried away with the plasma away from the shock front, but at the same time, they're losing energy. So at some point, if you are very far from the shock front, you don't see them anymore in X-rays. People call this the advection length, so it's delta V, the velocity with respect to the shock, times the loss time. And for Cas-A, we know that the shock velocity is 5,000 kilometers a second, which is measured in X-rays. So delta V is about 1,300 kilometers a second. If you then translate this 1 to 4 arc seconds into a lost time, it's 18 to 50 years. I take a broad range here. And the synchrotron lost time is 1 over b squared e. It's actually 630 b squared over e. On the other hand, of course, this gives you a combination of b and e. On the other hand, you also know that the photon energy that you get scales with e squared times b. So you can combine those results. So actually, here's first the cartoon. So particles are accelerated. There is a sort of net motion away. Of course, they scatter within the plasma. So sometimes they scatter back. But on average, they go away from the shock front. And if you take a compression ratio of 4, then you know that this length is 1/4 over the shock velocity times the loss time. And if you are very far downstream, you don't see any X-rays. So if you do that now graphically, of course, you can just do it algebraically, and then you get a nice magnetic field combination, energy out of it. I take some broad ranges because there are some uncertainties. There could be projection effects. There's, of course, that the synchrotron luminosity has a broad peak. So, you know, one energy can give several energies in photons. So if you take that into account, you see that it's broadly consistent with a magnetic field of, say, 100 to 500 microgauss, and energies between, say, 10 and 100 TeV. And just to point it out, it's much higher than the galactic magnetic field. There's also an alternative method, and people like Vilk and Beresko and Bamba used it. They say, well, actually, this business has nothing to do with the moving away from the shock front and losing energy. It's just a diffusion length scale for that for those energies. The diffusion length scale is defined as the diffusion parameter over U. If you then take the Bohm limit, so the fastest possible diffusion, you get this expression, and then you can also calculate. And actually, that is perpendicular to the rest of the plot. So actually, you take this line, and you take the dashed line, and where they cross, you also have the magnetic field. And what you see is actually that they sort of agree here. So how come they agree? Well, actually, what you can think of is that the diffusion length scale is the length scale over which particles can still get accelerated. If they're very far downstream, so further than the diffusion length scale, it's very unlikely that those particles will recross the shock front. But as soon as the advection length scale is so short that a lot of the particles within the diffusion length scale have lost their energies, there's no net acceleration anymore. So what you actually expect is that whenever the advection length scale is sort of similar to the diffusion length scale, you're no longer accelerating particles. So the two methods are more or less equivalent. And you can just show it also with some mathematics. So in order to have efficient acceleration, the acceleration time should be shorter than the loss time. Well, we know that the loss time is something like advection length scale over the velocity. So L advection is U times the loss time. And for the acceleration time, there is this expression which is, there are some numerical factors in front of it, but they're of order unity. So the acceleration time is the diffusion coefficient divided by U squared. So we only have acceleration if D over U squared is smaller than the loss time, which is L advection over U. For the diffusion length scale, we can write L diffusion is D over U. I already explained that in the previous slide. And what you actually get is that this is equivalent to this. So the diffusion length scale is always smaller than the advection length scale, or more or less similar. And clearly what we see here is that they are more or less similar. It's a little bit more complicated, of course, because they happen at the same moment. So probably what you see is a sort of convolution of the two. So the observed length scale is probably something like 0.7 times the advection length scale. So if you now look at all the young supernova remnants, there are more that have X-ray singleton emission, but here at least you see the X-ray singleton emission coming from close to the shock front, and you know the shock velocity. There is some uncertainty there, because sometimes it's just measured by seeing the expansion, but if you don't know the distance, there's an uncertainty there. If you just look at the really historical ones, they have something like velocity between 4,000 and 5,000 kilometers a second. If you use the diffusion length scale, you would get something between 33 and 300 microgauss. If you would use the loss time scale, you get something like between 40 and 250 microgauss. And you see that for all those numbers, they're very similar. So it doesn't really matter which method you're using. But actually, if you combine them and say there's a convolution of the two, the magnetic fields get a little bit higher. I don't know when I wrote that. It's an old slide. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know what the measurement error is here. Yeah. It doesn't affect the magnetic field that much. Anyway, what you should get away from this is that all young remnants have high magnetic fields, higher than just the compressed interstellar medium magnetic field, the average interstellar medium magnetic field. And the likely cause is actually that magnetic fields have been amplified by cosmic ray streaming. Today we heard some other talks about that. A name often attached to that is the Bell and Lucek mechanism, and Bell wrote also a recent paper. I don't know, there's also Weibull instabilities, what we heard about. But anyway, there must be some sort of method to enhance the magnetic fields. But also the fact that the diffusion, using the method of the diffusion approximation, versus the loss approximation gives more or less the same result. Different assumptions go into that. So for instance, for the loss time scale, we assume a compression ratio about 4. and we have to now the magnetic the shock velocity for the diffusion measurement. Actually, we also need a shock velocity, but it goes in another way. And we have to assume Bohm diffusion, so different assumptions. But nevertheless, the numbers you get are very similar, and they should be similar if the standard shock acceleration theory is right. So actually, you can sort of deduce from this that Bohm diffusion really works. And if the magnetic field enhancements are due to cosmic ray streaming, you need the ions to actually make this amplification of the cosmic rays, because you don't only need a high magnetic field, you also need a turbulence at length scales that are comparable to the gyro radius of the electron. So you need actually higher energy ions to do that. If you now look at the one with the highest magnetic field, Cas A, you see that for Cas A, you can easily reach, or easily you can reach the need 10 to the 15 EV. And even for metals, you can get much higher. And actually, there is some evidence that if you go beyond the need, the cosmic ray composition changes. So this is consistent with that. So you can maybe reach for heavy metal something like 10 to the 17 EV. Bell, in a recent paper, said that he expected that a magnetic field energy density should scale with the Ram pressure times V, so rho V to the third. Other people have assumed rho V squared. I plot here rho V to the third times with respect to B squared over 8 pi, and actually you see everything aligns very well. I have to caution a little bit, because there's a huge range that we are covering in densities between all those remnants, but there's not that much range in shock velocity. So I can't exclude really rho V to the second, and I can't even exclude rho V to the fifth. But at least it must have something to do with the Ram pressure. So because I used Jack-Hughes expansion measurement, and I don't know what the distance to Kepler is, so it's the most uncertain one of the all the historical remnants. So it's either 4.8 or 3 kiloparsec. So you see that what the typical changes in ranges in velocities here. Yeah, yes, sure. But they are hard to know. I don't know what the error is on the on the distance, right? There's not a statistical error test to it. It's more systematic. What it actually tells you now is that the supernova remnants with the highest magnetic fields are those that have a very high density and a very high shock velocity. And if you now want to accelerate most of your cosmic ray particles beyond the knee, what do you have to do? You have to have a very high density. And actually, you find that mostly in red supergiant winds. So early on, probably you have a much higher magnetic field. And actually, some of the speakers yesterday also showed that they need a very high magnetic field in the order of Gauss. And actually, that may help. Also, because you have a 1 over r squared, early on you have a very high density, so you keep on accelerating a lot of particles, because you multiply again with 4 pi to the r squared in order to get as many particles. So it may well be that the highest cosmic ray energies reaching our galaxy are in red supergiant winds, supernovae in red supergiant winds. Luckily, we have a lot of those. So, and Cas A, of course, is an example of that, but we catch it in a later state. So the even after maybe 200 years or 100 years, it may have reached 10 to the 15 EV. Now to another remnant, and I've worked on that quite recently. This is probably the oldest X-ray singleton emitter. I'm not quite sure of that, but it's a nice title. It's RCW86. I think it's one of Vikram's cavity remnants. It has a very thin shell. It's rather empty in the inside. It has a very low density in the inside. There's also a huge density contrast of about 10 or maybe even 100 in density. This is a mosaic from XMM Newton. What you see is here in blue again, patches of non-thermal emission. In red and yellow, you see thermal emission. And actually, Parviz showed that, I think in this region, he measured a shock velocity of 700 kilometers a second. Well, that's actually very surprising, because for 700 kilometers a second, you don't expect any X-ray singleton emission. Actually, Felix showed in one of his papers that the maximum photo energy that you can get scales with V to the power 2, independent of what kind of magnetic field you have. So how come that you have here non-thermal X-ray emission? The easiest to see, actually, maybe should go a little bit back. You see non-thermal emission in a lot of places, and here you see it inside the shock. Of course, this could be a geometrical effect. There's just some PET's face on that also emits X-ray singleton emission. But the easiest way to measure parameters like what is the thickness with respect to the shock is in the northeast. So I got XMM and Chandra observations of the northeast. Now actually north is up because then it fits better in this slide. So here's north, this is the northeastern part, and you see very surprisingly, you go along the shell and suddenly it goes from dominated by thermal emission to non-thermal emission. I have here some spectra. These are actually taken with XMM Newton because that's has a slightly higher spectral resolution. So indeed you see here some emission lines, and here it's mostly non-thermal with some hint of emission line. Yeah, yeah, I come to that. No, I don't say there is a contradiction. Just it was just a dramatic build-up. What is actually very surprising about that reason is also is you could say, okay, shock acceleration is much more efficient here in the sense that you have many more particles being accelerated. But that cannot be the case because if you look in radio, this part that is the same as this part is pretty weak actually. This part is much brighter. So the radio sort of roughly correlates probably with the interstellar medium density, and the thermal emission also correlates with the interstellar medium or the circumstellar medium density. So the overall density is probably very low here. And actually, your H-alpha image showed the same. There's hardly any H-alpha emission coming from that region. Now, from the width of this thing, about 45 arcseconds is a little bit more, but I calculated also some projection effects. And demanding now, using this picture, that the diffusion length scale should be more or less at the advection length scale, you can get out some vectors that you have a B field of about 20 microgauss and a shock velocity about 3,000 kilometers a second in order to explain the width and the maximum energy. This is much higher than Parviz measurements of the shock velocity in other parts of the remnant. And it requires actually large differences in shock velocity along the shell. And I think this is consistent with a shock partially interacting with a cavity wall. So in some parts, it went through a very low density medium and suddenly hit this wall and it decelerates very rapidly. And in other parts, it's not really really interacting with this wall yet and it has still a very high density. What is very nice actually about this whole thing, I never really believed the association between RCW 86 and supernova 185, a historical remnant, the oldest historical description of what may have been a supernova. But actually with 3,000 or 3,500 kilometers a second, you're very close to 185. So indeed, RCW 86 may be 185, supernova 185. It also suggests, I think, why some of those new X-ray singleton TEV remnants are very large and faint. In order to have TEV emission, you need a very high shock velocity. So you have either a young remnant that has not decelerated much, or you have an old, very large remnant, but it has not decelerated much because it hasn't swept up a lot of matter. So most of those TEV, new TEV supernova remnants are probably the ones in cavities. For the weakness of the radio, there's not that there are more electrons accelerated, they're just accelerated to much higher energies. I did also some analysis of the thermal spectra. What is very interesting, this is actually coming from XMM Newton, the MOS instrument. You go to the very bright thermal part, you get this spectrum, you see neon lines, iron L emission. This is a combination of oxygen 8 and oxygen 7, and this is oxygen 7. And if you can go to the fainter part, actually you see that the iron L is going down. And the ratio of oxygen 7 to oxygen 8 is going up, which probably means that you go to lower ionizations. So if you measure it now, you get this parameter NET, so the electron density times the time since the plasma has been shocked is very low. It's one of the lowest. Only 10^6 I know has such a low NET parameter. You can get a sort of measurement just from the emission region and the brightness, what the density is. It's about 0.5 per cube per centimeter. in the bright part, and that gives you something like 250 years. So probably this is the interaction time of the shock velocity with the cavity wall. And if you just calculate it, that means that delta R over R along this shell is something like 5%, which is very feasible if you look at the morphology of the supernova remnant. Actually, this is the faint thermal emission that you see from the singleton-dominated region. I took out the power law, so it's very noisy, but actually you don't see any iron L emission at all, and you see that oxygen 7 is brighter than oxygen 8. So this is even lower NET. So that confirms that the density there is very low. What I also did, so it's kind of surprising maybe that the radio singleton emission and the X-ray singleton emission sort of contradict. The radio emission is rather faint at that spot. So if you try to fit now with a sort of standard model, you just extrapolate the radio emission and you have the electrospectrum having an exponential cutoff, it's very hard to get the spectral slope right in X-rays. You don't have any room to play with, actually. You can just lower the electron, the maximum electron energy, but you see it won't work at all. Either you get this point, but you get the other points wrong, or the other way around. So what you need is actually a concave spectrum, like Don has been advocating for a long time. There are two things you can think of. One is you have really a high compression ratio, and you apparently go to a spectral slope of about 1.5. And that could do the job. So you see that there is a large deviation here, and you sort of match those 3 points. I can't really exclude, actually, that it's going to a spectral slope of about 2, so the standard Fermi acceleration. So both sort of fit the spectrum, and that is because you have much more room to play with. So where do you put the deviations from a straight line? But I think this is very neat, and actually you can also see this in Cas-A. And actually in Cas-A, some people have put this in infrared, so these are infrared points. But even you can fit all the points from radio to infrared to soft X-rays and hard X-rays just with a concave spectrum. The only problem then is I think Cas-A is actually the best case for pion decay because the density is so high. So if you want to see pion decay, Cas-A is probably the object. But still, you can get away with just inverse Compton. Cas-A is a little bit complicated because actually inverse Compton is not going on because of the microwave background, but Cas-A itself is a very strong infrared source. So most of the seed photons are coming from Cas-A itself, which makes it much harder to model the inverse Compton emission. There are some uncertainties, so I think it's a very nice picture. The fusion length scale sort of matches the advection length scale. But one of the basic assumptions is, of course, that the compression ratio is 4. And this whole nice picture goes away if you assume very large compression ratios. But there is some evidence for high compression ratio just from the hydrodynamics, mostly actually from Tycho. Don and Jessica have worked on that, and they say that in order to see to match the morphology of Tycho, you need very high compression ratio. So there is still an inconsistency in the picture of the TEV emission from, or the X-ray singleton emission from supernova remnants. Another thing that is still bugging me is actually that, of course, in Cas-A you have those very nice filaments at the outside. But what are all those non-thermal filaments on the inside? Is it just, are those really threads from at the outside? So not a sort of plain shock front, but are they threads and do you see them projected on the inside? Or is something else going on? And then actually this morning I thought maybe these are coming from the secondary electrons. That could be a solution. Could also be that some electrons are diffusing and going into the high magnetic field regions associated with the contact discontinuity in this remnant, where the magnetic field is much higher. And they briefly flare, and you get all those very nice filaments. They may be different because Tracy Delaney has actually shown that those filaments move at a slower expansion than those ones. So there may be quite different systems. So we need something else here. Which brings me to my summary and conclusions. So all young supernova remnants show evidence for X-ray singleton emission. The rim width can be interpreted as singleton cooling effect, and then they can be used to infer the magnetic field. Advection diffusion model requires Bohm diffusion. In order to match those two, they should be the same, and they're only the same if you assume Bohm diffusion. the magnetic field scales with the density, this should be an exponent, times v to some exponent, squared or cubed or whatever. The highest cosmic ray energies are probably reached early on in red supergiant winds. And for RCW86, it's the lowest B field of the historical remnants. I call it now a historical remnant. You need locally a very high shock velocity. And you need a concave electron spectrum in order to match both the radio and the X-ray emission. And there are some loose ends, so the RIMWIS model is not really consistent with a very high compression ratio, for instance, for Tycho. And we don't really know what the interior X-ray singleton emission of Cas A is telling us. Thank you.
For those synchrotron filaments that look like they're in the interior of Cas A, how do you know they're in the interior and not just projected?
Well, that's the whole discussion, basically. Yeah. But if they are projected, they must be threads also at the outside. So you don't have a nice picture that if you have, say, a very flat shock front, you see X-ray singleton emission all over the shock front within a certain width. So you need really threads in order to have them as threads on the inside. One argument against being projection is that they have a different, they seem to have a different expansion than the outside filaments. So the if you do a homologous expansion, no, they have a different, it's measured that their expansion is different. They have a different.
Yeah.
No, because you measure a relative. You measure the expansion system, not absolute expansion. That's what you're measuring. You're measuring
part of this. Is it part of this?
Okay. No. You measured a percentage effect. So the percentage should be the same for projection.
But the to see these projected in the center, you're really seeing tangencies of the shock going through this very complicated forward or rear cloud. And you see that complicated structure to the north where the forward shock is running into a CSM cloud or something like, or an ISM cloud. And so the velocities that you measure in terms of proper motion would be corrupted by the change of the tangencies as the forward shock moves around the clouds, and so that might explain what you're seeing.
Yeah, you may have complicated morphology.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this a different comment, or is it the same one? Oh, well, you're second.
Jacob, your argument in favor of this concave spectrum for electrons for non-linear shock, it's true, but you should take into account that the electrons which produce radio, they are not cooled, and these electrons produce X-rays, they are cooled, and for that reason, the spectrum which now we see in broadband, it strongly depends on the history of acceleration. In that sense, you could get different possibilities, not only assuming acceleration spectrum concave. Yeah. Now, but very much safer is point at infrared. These electrons also are not cooled. So, do we have some spectral point from, like, Spitzer?
Not for the supernova remnant. For Cas A, yes.
But that could be much more important than X-rays, because they are not cooled. You have one additional point, and you know spectrum in radio.
I'm just saying that the simple picture that most people are using, they see X-ray singleton emission, and they use SR cut in X-spec, which is just an electron spectrum with an exponential cutoff. And I think that, in general, doesn't work.
Yes, but you know, if something is cooled, then you have to
The exponential cutoff is because there is cooling. So you just assume, of course, it could be much more complicated.
But what I would say, the infrared point is not produced by electrons which are not cooled. And this quite far from radio frequencies. In that case, that is very safe.
Yeah.
to conclude is concave or not.
Yeah. Of course, it's very hard, I guess, for the infrared maybe to just isolate the shock front. Yeah.
Okay. So you have this nice model looking at this edge of the supernova remnant to get parameters for the diffusion of these electrons and advection downstream.
You're referring to a certain slide? Or?
No. Okay. But your model, okay. Mm-hmm. In the course of accelerating the radiating electrons, you're also accelerating protons, cosmic rays, which make secondary radio emission. So, and that is a plateau because it's not affected by losses. The protons just keep going.
Yeah.
So can you get a meaningful upper limit on the energy of the protons by looking for this plateau radio emission?
No, the only thing I can say, you know, you infer a magnetic field and you sort of infer from the observation that diffusion must be fast, so it must be close to Bohm diffusion, so you can get to 10 to the 15. I think it's very hard, indeed, if you have secondary electrons, but I think it's very hard to prove that some of the electrons are secondary electrons that you see in singleton emission. Yeah, actually, glass may be very important to get the Bremsstrahlung, but then it will be mostly electron Bremsstrahlung on the background particles.
So your first conclusion said that all young supernova remnants have X-ray synchrotron emission.
Yeah.
How many are there? Like, how many have we looked at?
So, of course, you have a number of historical remnants you can sort of count in Cas A. So you have only four or five, right?
Okay.
There are only five historical.
But all the ones that have been looked at have, with Chandra or something.
Yeah, all the historical remnants have X-ray synchrotron emission. So Kepler, Tycho, Cas A, 1006. RXA 1713, I didn't show that. And Vila Junior. They are probably young, but we don't really know their age.
Are there any things looked at with ROSAT, even, you know, others which you could go back and reanalyze and see if they have?
But that doesn't really matter, right? Okay. I mean, with ROSAT, you can't even isolate thermal from non-thermal. But
it's
no use. I mean, because the rims are so narrow, only Chandra can really do it for the high.
So you have only four or five at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think there are maybe six remnants that really have X-ray synchrotron emission. And more are getting known because of HESS, actually. Some of the new HESS sources turn out to be supernova remnants, or maybe Plerion, so some maybe pulsar wind nebula.
But at the moment, there's nothing which has been looked at that doesn't have.
No. What you basically need is high shock velocity. So if there is something with a high shock velocity, I'm sure that you will have X-ray synchrotron emission.
I'll take your word.
I have a comment on that. There are GT92 is a young remnant, 3,000 years old, and we haven't found thin synchrotron emitting rims in that. Have not, no.
And, but that is 3,000 years old, or not?
I said 3,000.
So I don't count it as young.
And then there's EO102 in the Magellanic clouds, which is about 1,000 to 2,000 years, in which we also don't see those rims. But that's Magellanic clouds.
Yeah. So I think some of the LMC remnants you pointed out 0509 probably has not.
Yes, probably does.
And that's one of the fastest. Right. Youngest remnants there.
But I wanted to ask you quickly, what do you consider the main problem to be with the higher shock compression in Tycho and why that seems to obviate
your
model?
So the magnetic fields go down if you use the advection length method, and they go up, I think, if you use the diffusion length.
Because we were able to actually get pretty good magnetic field estimates using Volkerdahl's model with a compression factor. I think we used 6 or 7.
Okay, well, I don't consider that very high. But if you go to 10 or more, I think it will be probably.
Okay, we did look at that, yeah.
John?
Synchrotron burn-off is one way to get a thin shell. But what about the other possibilities that the magnetic field annihilates again, goes away, because after all, you're just seeing a convolution of energetic particles.
I know Martin Pohl had a paper like that. Martin Pohl had a paper pointing this out, but actually he needed a high magnetic field to do it, I think. So I'm not sure if you can get it consistent. I think that the fact that it's so nice that whenever you use, whatever method you use, you get the same magnetic field is a sort of proof that this is the right thing. I mean, it's at least consistent, internally consistent. And I don't think his method is internally consistent, because he needs the high magnetic fields in the first place and then say, but they burn off.
With the RCW remnant, you were suggesting that you get that concavity, have evidence for the concavity in the spectrum. And of course, convolutions of turnovers and stuff like that complicate the picture. But presumably, GLAST is going to be sensitive enough to see the turnover cleanly, so that you'll know exactly how high the new peak is. Is that correct? Will it be able to get a clean, or is it a little bit
I think so, yeah. I just put in by hand a sort of break there, and I think in this case I took 10 to the 10 EV. So 10 GEV. Maybe Glass can see. RCW86 is maybe a difficult case. I think Cas A would be better because
right.
the density is low here. So you don't have that much Bremsstrahlung. I mm-hmm. think you refer to Bremsstrahlung. So Cas A is maybe a much better case. The Bremsstrahlung should be high.
Right, but I'm specifically talking about the RCW remnant in terms of being able to prove that it's that you've got a concave distribution.
Yeah, I would have to see how the Bremsstrahlung spectrum behaves and whether it's consistent with the Glass limits there.
Right.
Well, in principle, yes. If you could see the Bremsstrahlung there, you must be able to prove that there is mm-hmm. a concave spectrum. Yeah. 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 No, but that paper was no. That's for Cas A. Matthew is referring to RCW86. Yeah. For Cas A, yes. Actually, I did it myself by using the high end, the hard X-rays, which is maybe a little bit more uncertain because you have to fold in what the spectrum is doing below the relativistic limit.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next speaker.